This podcast is for investment professionals only. The value of investments and the income from them may go down as well as up, and investors may not get back the amounts originally invested. Past performance is not a guide to future performance. The information is not an offer, solicitation, or recommendation of any funds, services, or products, or to adopt any investment strategy.
Welcome to the Investor Download, the podcast about the themes driving markets now and in the future. My name's David Brett, and on today's show, we explore the world of energy transition, from the massive structural changes the oil industry is currently undergoing.
I went through $10 oil in 1998. I've never, ever seen capital expenditure cut of this magnitude from the entire industry.
To the potential it offers investors.
It's not a one-year investment opportunity. It's not even a five-year investment opportunity. This is a good 10 to 20-year structural shift in the energy system, and it needs $100 trillion of capital expenditure between now and 2050.
And the threats that exist.
And there is no way, I'm going to say on this call, that the energy transition stocks would be immune to that slowdown.
Hello, how are you? I hope you're all safe and well. Big Oil's green makeover. That was the banner headline in the Washington Post in mid-September. BP, one of the largest oil companies in the world, had just announced an aggressive new policy to cut oil and gas output by 40% and to increase its investment in low-carbon energy tenfold to $5 billion a year by 2030. It's not the only oil company to do so. Royal Dutch Shell, among others, have also recently announced plans to reinvent themselves in the age of climate change. Big companies reinventing themselves in the face of disruption is nothing new. IBM shifted from mainframes to software and services successfully. And more recently, Netflix switched from posting DVDs to online streaming. There's plenty of other examples. But we're seeing a huge structural shift in the energy sector. And it's affecting everyone from big oil to firms making parts for wind turbines. It's all part of the energy transition. And after the UK government announced it hopes that all homes in the UK will be powered by wind power by 2030, we felt it was a good time to speak to Mark Lacey, a fund manager, about what's happening in the oil industry and investing in the energy transition theme. So, in the first part of the show, we address the elephant in the room. Have we seen peak oil? And what do we actually mean by energy transition?
On Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts, you're listening to the Investor Download.
Perhaps unsurprisingly, oil prices have been weak as a result of the pandemic. With businesses shutting down, the demand for oil has dried up. From its peak of around $80 a barrel in September 2018, prices went negative for the first time in history in March as traders struggled to find storage as COVID spread. But the real story behind oil's decline begins 17 years ago.
You have to really go all the way back to the period of 2003, all the way through to 2012, where oil prices were on just a steady climb because we had this structural undercapacity in the oil market. And $100 oil sustained between 2011 and 2015 in particular led to a ridiculous amount of projects being sanctioned. And at the same time, it led to a huge amount of development on US onshore shale.
Lacey says in those days, demand was never the issue. The problem was reckless development, specifically by US firms, which brought about oversupply. That oversupply eventually collided with the collapse in demand brought about by COVID.
And the demand collapse cannot be underestimated. You know, normal demand levels for this time of the year should be at around about 100 to 101 million barrels a day. Because of jet fuel consumption is running at almost 50% of normal levels, because as you know, no one is traveling because of the COVID pandemic. The oil market is actually running at around about 93 million barrels a day in terms of demand at the moment.
And that has forced oil firms to cut the supplies.
I've never, ever seen this response. I mean, I started investing in 1996 and I went through $10 oil in 1998. I've never, ever seen a capital expenditure cut of this magnitude from the entire industry.
With cuts coming at an historic rate, demand still in capitulation, and the oil price still only around $40 a barrel, it's forcing oil companies to shift their business models towards cleaner energy. So the big question is, have we seen peak oil?
It's a good question because BP, with their drastic business model change to get to net zero emissions by 2050, and aggressive targets for 2030 have said we've probably reached peak oil. And what they mean is peak oil in terms of demand, of course. We don't think we've reached peak oil demand. The reason being is we're under the assumption that the COVID-19 pandemic not only dies down, but effectively goes away. And this restores people's desire for air travel. So that's the first point. But secondly, think about the global car pool. It's 1.4 billion vehicles globally. So even if you have very, very high penetration rates on electric vehicles, i.e. 25% penetration rates, which we're seeing in some economies already, you still end up with peak oil demand occurring at about 2027, 2028. That's based on our estimates. So we don't think we've quite reached peak oil yet, but certainly over the next 7 to 8 years, we think the oil market will start to plateau.
If we are soon to see peak oil, then what next? Energy transition is a phrase that we hear often, but what does it mean?
So the energy transition is a structural shift in the entire energy system, and it's the first time it's going through this change in 70 years. Traditionally, investment in energy goes through what we call investment cycles, so it's cyclical. Prices increase. Whether it's power prices or oil prices or gas prices, that attracts investment, that reduces the undersupply, and sometimes you end up with excess supply, as we mentioned earlier in oil, and then prices come back down. And that they're the cycles that we have on a continuous basis. Well, if you go back to 70 years ago, you had the first adoption of oil in the energy mix, and it effectively took around about 70 years from early 1900s all the way through to 1970 for oil to get to 50% of the energy mix. Renewables at this point in time only make up around about 7% of the energy mix. And this structural shift that's occurring is we think renewables will get to 50% of the energy mix by 2050.
But it's not just about switching from fossil fuels to clean energy.
What it is in an entire upgrade of the energy system in order to facilitate the grid with regards to wind and solar, you need to upgrade transmission and distribution lines. You need storage to effectively utilize wind and solar while it's windy and while it's sunny. And then you can basically dispatch the electricity when it's not windy and when it's not sunny. At the same time, you need charging infrastructure to facilitate the consumer side of the energy transition, which is effectively the take up of electric vehicles. All of this wrapped together effectively gets you towards a reduced carbon emissions program now and 2050. And it's effectively becoming almost a global buy-in.
So the experts believe we are approaching peak oil, and big oil majors seem to have recognised that, with companies such as BP setting out their energy transition plans. In the next section of the show, we're going to explore why now, and perhaps as importantly, why has it taken so long?
Get in touch with us by email at shorterspodcasts@shorters.com or visit our website, shorters.com/investor download.
When world leaders got together in 2015 in Paris, they signed an accord to limit the rise in global temperatures to 2 degrees above pre-industrial levels by 2100. It doesn't sound much, but it's a tough target to hit. Schroders has built a dashboard to provide an objective measure of the progress being made to limit that rise. It currently shows that global temperatures are actually on course to rise by 3.4 degrees.
That is unsustainable. And the reason is if we suffer those temperature increases, you ultimately have sea levels increasing by anywhere between 3 and 6 feet, based on scientists' estimates. You have 2/3 of the Amazon rainforest will suffer deforestation. And so that is catastrophic with regards to our everyday habitat. It's been identified as early as 2005, that this is unsustainable. But from 2015, you started to get more coordination in moving towards a low carbon energy system. And the challenge is not just between now and 2100. In order to get back to a 2 degree increase in temperatures, a much nearer target is by 2030, you need to reduce carbon emissions by 33%. So it's here and now that you effectively need us to move to that low carbon energy system.
Concern for the environment is clearly the biggest driving force. None of us want oceans drowning our landscapes and destroying our habitat. Rhetoric is all well and good, but what about action? What else is driving the need for energy transition?
We're starting to reach a point where we have global buy-in. China are pushing towards investment in new infrastructure. That's a $1.7 trillion program to get to a large mix, almost 30% in some states, of renewable energy generation. And bear in mind, they're a big coal producer, so this is a big challenge for them. The most talked about one is the European Commission's Green Deal, where they're using the current stimulus program to effectively invest a large part of the $750 billion in renewables, green hydrogen, electric vehicle, purchasing subsidies and charging systems. But the big game changer is if Joe Biden gets elected, because part of his policy is 100% clean electricity standard by 2035. But more importantly, it's a $2 trillion investment program over the next 4 years in clean energy. To put that in perspective, that is 4 to 5 times the current run rate of the US's investment in fossil fuels. And it's the driver behind this energy transition is driven by governments identifying the need from an environmental perspective, but you've also got consumer take up with regards to accessibility for electric vehicles as well. And all these combine to basically create an unbelievable investment opportunity over the next few decades. It's not a one-year investment opportunity. It's not even a five-year investment opportunity. This is a good 10 to 20-year structural shift in the energy system, and it needs $100 trillion of capital expenditure between now and 2050.
So there is will from governments, and the trend towards electric cars is intensifying. But we've known about this for years, so why now for energy transition?
That's a very good question, and it's economics. So if we go even back to 2010 and we look at the levelized cost of energy for solar PV or for onshore wind, at $1.8 per watt and $1.7 per watt, respectively, the only way the solar farms and the wind farms were economic were because of subsidies. And you remember we had the removal of subsidies in 2012, and that's when this entire renewable energy sector collapsed. What we've seen with solar PV is that you've seen a 28% increase in efficiency per annum all the way out till 2020, so to the current year. And this is important because at less than $0.2 per watt, it now competes and is at a discount to combined cycle gas turbines and to coal-fired power stations. Exactly the same for onshore and offshore wind. They haven't come as low as solar PV because they've been increasing efficiency by 11% per annum. But they're now at a point at $0.7 per watt where they compete with combined cycle gas turbines and they compete with coal. So economics is a massive driving force for the investment rates increasing and the viability.
Which in part explains why you might have seen in the press the announcement by the UK government that expects all homes to be powered by wind turbines by 2030. But there are challenges.
Solar and wind has limitations, though, and we accept that. And so the next stage in terms of efficiency is capturing wind and solar through storage, which we think is going to be a significant growth area in the next couple of decades. And at the same time, where you've had efficiency gains in solar and wind, you've had huge efficiency gains in lithium-ion batteries. So this works for both storage and for also the cost viability for an electric vehicle. Now, the pricing crossover for an electric vehicle relative to an internal combustion engine vehicle is around about $100 per kilowatt hour. And in 2020, we've reached that. We've reached that after the price in 2010 for a lithium-ion battery was running at just under $1,200 per kilowatt hour. So you've seen massive reductions in cost, which enable the producing capability of these power plants, effectively through solar and wind, competing with conventional. And at the same time, it allows the consumer to access the technology through lower vehicle prices.
Governments appear to be stepping up with their policies targeting energy transition, but what are the major oil companies doing?
Yeah, that is a massive question because it depends on the company within the integrated. I mentioned earlier that Exxon and Chevron, they have a very, very limited, renewable policy at this point in time. Exxon, there was a document leaked last week in the Wall Street Journal that even suggested that they're forecasting their own CO2 emissions increase by 17% over the next 5 years. If that is the case, that is shocking, but it still needs to be confirmed by the company themselves. BP and Shell and Total and Equinor in Europe and Eni have all been vocal that almost 100% of their growth capital expenditure will be diverted towards the energy transition. Now, part of that will be in the form of investing in solar and wind. But a big part of that, which we think Royal Dutch Shell are actually well positioned for, is in hydrogen. Because it's not just about solar and wind. The energy transition is about clean energy. And hydrogen plays a massive part in trucking infrastructure. You can't put a lithium-ion battery on a truck. To put it in perspective, it's about 14 tons. So green hydrogen is a key growth area that the majors can play a part. And bear in mind, Royal Dutch have already sunk a huge amount of capital expenditure in this area. So this is an area where they have existing infrastructure through their refineries. They have existing infrastructure with regard to their distribution outlets. And they understand the technology of converting existing power into effectively clean hydrogen. So you have the skill set, you have the infrastructure. That is the obvious area for where the majors will play. But to be clear, they will be investing across the entire value chain by diverting the current oil and gas capital expenditure. And that's a clear mandate that both Royal Dutch, Total, BP and Equinor, et cetera, have between now and 2050.
Although BP's plans are ambitious, Lacey says energy companies have the will to execute those plans. And he says they'll need to, otherwise they'll be held to account by investors. So it looks like energy companies are doing their bit for energy transition, but one government is conspicuous for its lack of policy in the area. So in the final part of the show, ahead of the US election at the start of November, we're going to find out what a Trump or Biden presidency will mean for the future of energy transition. The US election is set to take place on Tuesday, November the 3rd, between Republican incumbent Donald Trump and Democratic nominee and former Vice President Joe Biden. And their green energy policies could not be more different.
If Trump wins, the existing President Trump, it will definitely slow down the energy transition at the federal level. Bear in mind he sanctioned the Keystone XL pipeline, which is basically north to south pipeline for effectively heavy crude. That's in contrast to Biden, that, as I mentioned earlier, wants to introduce a $2 trillion investment in clean energy over the next 4 years. So if Biden gets in, obviously it accelerates the energy transition. But the reason I said at the federal level is because that's important. At the state level, already, you've got quite, not aggressive, very sensible targets at the state level. So take California. That's the most well-known state that is pushing towards renewables. They have 100% of all electricity in California must be from zero emission sources by 2045. And they're already targeting, as in another example, an aggressive 5 million zero emission vehicles in California by 2025. And the infrastructure, they acknowledge the infrastructure has to be put in. So they're saying 250,000 EV chargers. If you take Pennsylvania, for example, a massive coal and gas state, they've already proposed a bill for 100% power in Pennsylvania by 2050. So at the federal level, there is this massive influence, but don't detract from the fact that at the state level, you're still getting really, really good progress and investment is increasing. So you have to separate those two parts.
A clear divide then between the two candidates. But what is the stock market telling us about who it thinks might win?
The price performance of whether it's the inverter companies like Enphase and SolarEdge have performed extremely well this year. Both those stocks are up over 100% for the year to date. And so the polysilicon providers, which are listed on the US market, have been extremely strong. Wind blade manufacturers such as TPI have been very, very strong. Across the entire value chain, the sector has been very, very strong. So I think to answer your question, David, there is a, you're seeing a building perception that Biden is clearly the favorite for the US election. But I don't want this to turn into a political debate. One of the clear drivers behind those stocks performing is not the election. The biggest driver is the visibility of earnings. And that's what drives companies in terms of performance. Visibility of earnings and a return on invested capital above the cost of capital. So the share price performance is really strengthening, and you're seeing a re-rating of those stocks because you've got visibility of earnings 2, 3, 4, and 5 years out now. And so as much as a Trump victory would slow some of those growth rates in some areas, it's very marginal given the consumer take-up of these individual products and given the speed at which these renewable projects are being put in place.
Share prices have already risen then, but not just in anticipation of a change of leadership in the US. It's about a longer-term structural shift. So what does that mean for valuations?
They've come up, they've re-rated. I mean, this sector was trading at about a 15% discount to the broader market around about 12 months ago, which we thought was mad, given the visibility of growth. And you've seen that re-rating. And on average, across our entire energy transition universe, a broad spread, they're trading in line with the market now. And we would say that's still unjustified because you've got so much visibility on earnings. Now, that was the entire universe. There are pockets where the valuations have become a little bit stretched or very stretched. Let's be very clear. Hydrogen names, for example, on our valuation screens look ridiculously overbought relative to their earnings capability if you look 5 years and even 10 years out. Whereas other parts of the sector, for example, the equipment manufacturers on the renewable side and electrical equipment manufacturers, which are also huge beneficiaries of this energy transition, and we think they're trading effectively at a discount. It's a long-term investment thing, David. That's the clear message. This is a structural shift in the energy system that happens once every 70 years. I mean, literally the last time we went through this structural shift was the oil market developing, and what accelerated the oil market was obviously the automobile. What we've got here is a structural shift in the way we produce electricity, and then ultimately that eats into the internal combustion engine market share from a transportation fuel perspective as well, as does hydrogen. And this is a structural shift. So investors should be very comfortable with regards to the visibility of the long-term growth in this sector. The only structural shift I can relate this to, because of my age at 48, is the adoption of the internet. And you know, in the late 1990s, the internet basically changed everything the way we do in terms of the way we communicate with each other, the way we display media, etc. You know, the way we advertise. So this structural shift in the energy system just cannot be underestimated, because none of us listening to this call has ever gone through one of these structural shifts in the past before.
So some valuations are on the high side, but there are pockets of opportunities still there for investors. But are there any risks on the horizon?
The biggest risk at this point in time is if the COVID pandemic worsens aggressively from current levels again. We've got warning signs that the pandemic is potentially causing shutdown in parts of Europe and in parts of Asia at this point in time, and in parts of South America. And if it accelerates, and that will push a large parts of the economy into recession. It's hard for companies to invest. And there is no way, I'm going to say on this call, that the energy transition stocks would be immune to that slowdown. They weren't immune to that slowdown and stock market weakness in March. And they proved robust and resilient on a relative basis, but they definitely pulled back. You had some stocks down 20 to 30%. So I don't want to say they would have been immune to that. And that is the biggest risk at this point in time from where we sit.
Well, that was the show. We very much hope you enjoyed it. If you want to get in touch with us about anything in the show or have ideas for future shows, contact us at schroderspodcasts@schroders.com. You can read more from Mark Lacey at schroders.com/insights. To listen to more from the Investor Download, go to schroders.com/the Investor Download. Or rate, review and subscribe to us at Apple Podcasts, Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts. New shows are available every Monday and Thursday from 5 p.m. UK time. But above all else, keep safe and go well. Cheers.